So we're in Joshua chapter 7. Good start. Last week we saw in Joshua chapter 6 the fall of Jericho, the miraculous victory that God granted to his people. Everything went well, everything went just as it should, so it seemed. Look at the last verse of chapter 6, verse 27. So the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame spread throughout all the land. That's the high note of chapter 6. And now the Israelites go after another place, which is called Ai, or Ai. Probably Ai, we said, but you were in A&E when we talked about that. So basically, if you imagine that this banner is the land, is the promised land, the people of kind of Egypt is over there somewhere. The people have kind of hooked underneath it, and they've come up to here. This is the Jordan here, and Jericho is about here. So they've crossed over the Jordan, they've captured Jericho, and the next obvious place is Ai, which is about here. So it's the obvious way into the land is where they're going. And what happens is they go up to this place called Ai. Ai means ruin. So maybe it's possible people think that it was a very old city and it had been occupied and then it had been destroyed or abandoned. So it looked like a ruin and then more people had come to live in it. And then the scouts went up and maybe they thought it looks like a ruin, so it's not too impressive. So we don't need very many men. Joshua sends 3,000 men, and then the people are defeated. And that is a shock to us. It's a shock to them. And it raises some questions about a few things. It raises questions about sin and its consequences, because we know what's happening if you've read verse 1. It raises questions about how we respond when things go wrong in our lives or when things go wrong in the church. The whole community suffers when only Achan sins. It raises questions about whether that's true for us. It raises questions about the future of Israel. What is going to happen to Israel? Is that it? Is it curtains for Israel? What happens to us when we sin? Is that the end? What happens if there's sin in the church? Is the church done for in that scenario? Well, we're going to look at Joshua chapter 7 in three sections, which I've called the Lord's anger burned, and then the seriousness of sin, and then the Lord's anger turned. So firstly, the Lord's anger burned, looking at verses 1 to 9. Now, we're not in the dark about the reason for what happens, because if you look at verse 1, we know something that they don't know. We read this, but the Israelites were unfaithful in regard to the devoted things. Achan, son of Carmi, son of Zimri, son of Zerah, of the tribe of Judah, took some of them. So we're told straight away what's happened, but remember, Joshua doesn't know that, and the people don't know that straight away. Having said that, what he did is pretty clear to the Israelites, is wrong. It's been clearly warned against. So the command not to take any of these devoted things from Jericho was clear, and the consequences were clear. Look back with me to chapter 6 and verse 17. So this is what Joshua says just after he said shout, and as Tom said last week, he probably didn't actually say this at that point because he'd have been drowned out by their shouting. So the author has made a choice to emphasize this by putting it in a different place to where it belongs. Joshua says, the city and all that is in it are to be devoted to the Lord. Only Rahab the prostitute and all who are with her, etc., etc. But keep away from the devoted things so that you will not bring about your own destruction by taking any of them. Otherwise, you will make the camp of Israel liable to destruction and bring trouble on it. Okay, so it's pretty clear that that's the wrong thing to do, and it's also pretty clear what the consequences are going to be. Keep away from the devoted things, says Joshua. And the great irony of this is if you flip forward a chapter to chapter 8 and verse 2, when the people go up against Ai, God says to them, you shall do to Ai and its king as you did to Jericho and its king, except that you may carry off their plunder and livestock for yourselves. So if Achan had just waited and trusted God, maybe he could have had a really nice robe and some silver and gold, and he should have been patient, perhaps. But go back to verse 1 of chapter 7, and we read at the end of verse 1, "So the Lord's anger burned against Israel." Now, we thought about the God's anger burning against the Canaanites, the idea that the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land, are under God's judgment. We've read the sin of the Amorites reaching its full measure. But God's people are safe, surely. They're the agents of God's judgment. We've seen how he promised to give them the land. We've seen how Rahab escaped from the Canaanites, escaped judgment, by coming into God's people. She's safe now, but we have this frightening prospect here that God's anger is burning, not against the Canaanites, but against his own people. I wonder, do we today fear God's anger or fear God's discipline? Do we think God gets angry with his people today, with the church? Listen to some of the words of Jesus from Revelation chapter 2 and chapter 3. This is Jesus' words to local churches. He says, "If you do not repent, I will come to you and remove your lampstand from its place." And he also says, "Those whom I love, I rebuke and discipline." Perhaps we need to remember that God does discipline his people, that his anger can even burn against them. I think we need to have a healthy fear of God, and we'll see why it's a healthy thing to have a fear of God as we keep reading Joshua 7. So what happens? They don't know what we know in verse 1. But what did happen? Verse 2 and 5, they go up, or the scouts, first of all, go up to look at Ai, and they come back and say, it's not a big place, we'll probably be all right. And maybe the scouts didn't do their job properly. Maybe everyone was feeling very overconfident after the experience of Jericho. Things are going really well, we don't really need to try that hard. Maybe they didn't pray, there's no mention of prayer. Maybe Joshua didn't send enough men. Those things could be true, but the root cause is the anger of God. Verse 1, we've already been told what the root cause was. God, of course, was sovereign over what happened, and that was the means of his judgment. And the primary lesson here for Israel is not just that they need to be more careful in the way they scout, or that they need to make sure they send enough men to capture the objective. And that might have been true, but the primary lesson is that it's sin that has caused this. You see, God can and does discipline us through ordinary events that happen to us. Recently we bought a new car, or a second-hand car that was new to us, and about a week after we'd owned it, all the tiles from our roof fell off our roof and landed on the car and damaged it. And then about a week after that, I reversed it into our wall and broke one of the lights. And I remember Katie saying to us, "The Lord is really teaching you to hold on to your stuff, isn't he?" And I think, you know, maybe there was some truth in that as I examined my heart and my attitude towards my new car. You see, the primary lesson isn't that we need to make sure our roof is okay, or that's probably true. The primary lesson is maybe something deeper. So God disciplines and God punishes unconfessed sin. I think we need to be aware of that. Psalm 66 says this, the psalmist writes, "If I had cherished sin in my heart, the Lord would not have listened." If I had cherished sin in my heart, the Lord would not have listened. And the psalmist is suggesting that God does not listen to our prayers if we harbour unrepentant sin in our hearts. That's a sobering thought for us tonight. So how does Joshua respond when he hears about it? When the people come back, or some of the people come back, the remaining people come back, Joshua prays, but look what he prays. Verse 7, "Why did you bring us to destroy us?" Does that sound familiar? Maybe it reminds you of what the Israelites did when they grumbled against God in the desert. You see, it doesn't seem to occur to Joshua that sin might be the problem. And he almost seems to lay the blame with God. There's really no room in what he prays for sin on the part of the Israelites. I wonder if he sort of realized that sin might be the problem instead of God being the problem. And when things go wrong in our lives, when things go wrong in the church, do we examine our own hearts before we complain to God? God disciplines his people. He disciplines his church. May God guard us against the danger of being blind to our own sin or the possibility of our own sin or sin amongst us. Now there may be things wrong with Joshua's prayer, but as Johnny said, the fact that he prays, the fact that his reaction is to fall on his face before God is, I think, a good thing. You see, he understands that the conquest is wholly dependent on God. If you look at what's actually happened, 36 men have died. Now that's tragic, but if you look at the numbers that are involved in Israel, they had thousands and thousands of fighting men, and 36 men is not a serious loss. They haven't lost any ground. You could easily recover from this, humanly speaking. But the point is, the defeat shows them that God isn't with them. And Joshua recognizes that everything is lost if God is not with them. Do we think the same, I wonder? If we had reason tonight to think that God was withdrawing his help from Emmanuel, we should be in despair. The very thought of that should bring us to our knees. Do we instead have this subconscious idea that we carry on in our own strength as we always have done? Or do we remember that we are as dependent on God as Joshua and the Israelites were as they were going into the promised land? The Lord's anger burned. Secondly, the seriousness of sin, verse 10 to 21. So the Israelites have been defeated. Joshua has prayed to God. And now God answers Joshua. And look at God's answer to Joshua in verse 10. The Lord said to Joshua, "Get up. What are you doing down on your face? Israel has sinned." So God's answer is not really very sympathetic to Joshua's prayer, is it? To Joshua's blaming God or asking God why he isn't doing his job. God's answer is basically, get up and deal with the issue, which is sin. Implication is perhaps, Joshua, you should have worked this one out. Remember what you said not such a long time ago to the Israelites in front of Jericho. That's happened now. And then look at verse 11. Verse 11 says, "Achan has sinned. Achan has violated my covenant, which I commanded him to keep. Achan has taken some of the devoted things. Achan has stolen. He has lied. He has put them with his own possessions." Well, if you're looking at verse 11, that's not actually what it says. It says, "Israel has sinned. They have violated my covenant, which I commanded them to keep. They have taken some of the devoted things. They have stolen. They have lied. They have put them with their own possessions." God's view is that Israel is guilty because of the one man's sin. There's a lot of "they" when really only Achan and his children, we might say, are individually responsible for it. What's going on there? Well, I think it's exposing a principle, and the principle is that sin on the part of the individual affects the whole community of God's people. So, for example, in 1 Corinthians 11, Paul is writing to a church in Corinth, and there were lots of people in that church who weren't taking the Lord's Supper seriously enough. And Paul says people were getting ill, and some people were dying because of it. Now, that must have had a massive effect on the church. I mean, incidentally, I don't think we're explicitly told that the people who weren't taking the Lord's Supper seriously are the same people as the people who were dying. But even if they were, imagine if one of us died because we weren't taking the Lord's Supper seriously. That would affect our whole community, wouldn't it? The whole community is affected by the consequences of sin. And Paul had no hesitation in linking their sin in the church of Corinth with what was happening in their in the church as a whole, in their community. The whole community was contaminated, was affected by sin and by the consequences of sin. David Jackman writes this: the individual functions in the context of his community. Okay, the individual functions in the context of his community. I think that's an important principle that we maybe lose sight of in our Western society, which is very individualistic. You see, your actions will affect the other people in your family, the other people in Emmanuel, the other people in the society that you're part of, the other people in the country. I remember in the past seeing when some great crime has happened, perhaps some murderer or some mass murderer is arrested, and they interview the people who lived nearby on the same street. And you can see the shock, the impact that this great sin has had on the community that's around them. And what about us? Well, if you commit adultery, your wife or your husband will be affected by that. Your children will be affected. If you gossip in Emmanuel, unloving talk will breed amongst us. If you speak sharp words in Emmanuel, our relationships will be damaged, our trust will be damaged. You see, the effects of even small sins are far-reaching in the community. The whole community can be contaminated by sin and by the effects of sin, and also by God's judgment, God's discipline of sin. So God says the problem is sin amongst the community, but God also gives a solution. Look at verse 13. Go, consecrate the people. Tell them, consecrate yourselves in preparation for tomorrow. For this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. There are devoted things among you, Israel. You cannot stand against your enemies until you remove them. And then he instructs them to go through this process whereby the guilty man will be exposed. Achan has associated himself with these things that should have been devoted to destruction. And now that he's associated himself with those things, he will also be devoted to destruction. And then verse 16, that's exactly what they do. Joshua made Israel come forward tribe by tribe, and Judah was chosen. The clans of Judah then come forward as it kind of narrows down. And then the Zerahites were chosen, and then all the clans of the Zerahites come forward. And then this clan of Zimri was chosen, and then this clan comes forward, and Achan is chosen. And all the time this search is narrowing down. And Achan says nothing that we're told about, until he's confronted. Maybe he was somehow hoping he'd get away with it. But there's no hiding from the judgment of God. Sooner or later, God will expose all sin. Maybe we thought about that in 1 Timothy this morning, about the sins of some men trailing behind them, but the sins of other men being obvious. Sooner or later, sin will be exposed. They can maybe look like he got away with it for a short while, but God exposed it and God judged it. So Achan is exposed and Joshua confronts him. And then what he says is actually very instructive. Look at verse 20. Joshua has charged him to tell the truth and confess. And Achan replied, "It's true. I have sinned against the Lord, the God of Israel. This is what I've done." He recognizes that his sin is against the Lord, the God of Israel, not against those 23 people who died, not against the widows and orphans of those 23 men who died. All sin is primarily against God, including Achan's sin, which was actually to take things that belong to God, to steal from God. And look at verse 21, and end of 20, Achan says, "This is what I have done." Verse 21, his summary: "When I saw in the plunder a beautiful robe from Babylonia, 200 shekels of silver and a wedge of gold weighing 50 shekels, I coveted them and took them. They are hidden in the ground inside my tent with the silver underneath." his account. He saw, he coveted, he took, and he hid. We need to be careful where we look, perhaps. Sin can begin with such a seemingly innocent thing. He just saw those things. And that eventually led to his sin. And we need to perhaps be careful what we read. We can sometimes take steps to make sure that we don't put ourselves in the way of temptation. Maybe be careful what we read. Be careful what we watch on TV. Be careful what we watch on YouTube. Be careful about the films we choose to go and see. Remember the story of David and Bathsheba. Taking a walk on the roof was the start, wasn't it, of everything that happened. If taking a walk on the roof is likely to put us in a place of temptation, let's not even do it in the first place. Let's have a sloping roof like most of us do. So we can't. The point is, we can take steps, can't we, to avoid going into that place of temptation. Not always, but sometimes. And where we can, let's do that. Achan saw the things, and maybe he couldn't avoid doing that, and then he coveted the things. Be careful what you think, even. Achan coveted the things he saw. That seems perhaps innocent enough. I'm sure it did at the time. Maybe he was just imagining what life would be like if he was wearing that robe as he walked through the camp of Israel. Maybe he was just fantasizing about what he could buy with all that silver. Just letting his imagination play for a little moment with what might happen if those things were his. But you see, thoughts lead to actions. Be careful where your thoughts take you. Bad thought patterns will lead us into sinful actions. Listen to Paul. Paul puts this positively, so the other way around, in Philippians 4, when he says, "Finally, brothers and sisters, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things." So he says, rather than saying, don't think about things that are unhelpful, he says, think about these things. There are plenty of things, aren't there, that are true, that are noble, that are right, that are pure, that are lovely, etc. For instance, Jesus. So maybe when we find ourselves in thought patterns that are not going to help us, like Achan was coveting the things he saw, maybe imagining what things would be like if he owned those things. Maybe when we find ourselves in sinful thought patterns, why don't we make a conscious effort to direct our thoughts somewhere else, like towards Jesus? Or towards some Bible passage that you know well? Or maybe one of the songs that we sing in Emmanuel? That would be a great way, wouldn't it, of thinking about whatever is true, noble, right, pure, lovely, admirable, and praiseworthy. And that is the way to head off sin. You see, if Achan had stopped there and had then turned his thoughts to things that Paul had written about in Philippians 4, the anger of the Lord wouldn't have burned against Israel, would it? But he didn't. Having coveted the things, he took them. If he'd stopped there, then, as we thought, the judgment would not have come. He wouldn't have been sinless. But there is an added seriousness, I think, when sins of the mind become sinful actions. Sinful actions are wrong, and we must avoid them. And then lastly, having taken them, he says he hid them. I wonder who he thought he was fooling. Well, pretty much everyone. He fooled the Israelites, he fooled Joshua. No one knew. It wasn't that God said, there is sin amongst the Israelites, and then Joshua went, that'll be Achan. No, he didn't know. That's why they had to go through that whole process of narrowing it down to Achan. He'd fooled everyone, hadn't he? But he couldn't hide it from God. God is not fooled. We mustn't fall into the trap of thinking that sin doesn't matter if no one else sees it. Because that doesn't mean that we can sin without consequences. If you look lustfully at a woman, no one might know your sin, but it will affect the way you view women, the way you treat women. Lots of people in our society think and speak as if pornography is a victimless sin, or maybe not even a sin at all. But that's not true. There are studies that have shown that women are treated much worse by men who view pornography. But the most important thing is that if you sin and no one sees, God knows. You will not escape his displeasure, and it will not help to hide sin, because you cannot hide sin from the God who sees everything. Sin needs to be confessed, and it needs to be repented of. So Achan saw, he coveted, he took, and he hid. Does that remind you of anything? Or remember Eve in the garden? She saw, she coveted, she took, and ate. And then Adam and Eve hid from God. I wonder if we're supposed to notice that. You see, the conquest of the land is going ahead. The people are going into the land. This is a blip, as we'll see. The conquest goes on. God is giving his people the promised land. But I wonder if this is a little flag to say, the problem of Eden, the problem of sin, the problem of what happened in the garden is not going to go away anytime soon. We're not to look at the conquest of Jericho and Ai for God's final salvation, but there's something greater, someone greater who is coming. Thirdly and finally, the Lord's anger turned. So the Lord's anger burned, the seriousness of sin, and now the Lord's anger turned, verse 22 to 26. So here in verse 22, Joshua sent messengers, they ran to the tent. They ran to the tent. This is so important. It needs to be dealt with. It's vital. And they found that it was just as Achan had said, his confession was true. And then verse 24, Joshua with all Israel took Achan, the silver, the robe, the gold wedge, his sons, his daughters, his cattle, his donkeys, his sheep, his tent, and all that he had to the valley of Achor. And then they stoned them and burned them and built a large heap of stones over them. You see, the people of Israel are purging the sin, just as God said, by destroying the devoted things. So that's exactly what should have happened originally to the robe and the gold and the silver. They should have been destroyed. But now Achan and his children and everything he owns, they've now become associated with the devoted things. And they're devoted to destruction as well. Sin must be rooted out. Achan and his children died because of sin. We don't know exactly what role his children played. It must have been pretty obvious if their father was digging a hole in the middle of a tent. But we don't know. We're not told that. But either way, it's humanly horrifying, isn't it? That these people are stoned to death and all their things are burnt. But really, we should be spiritually horrified by this, because it's showing us how dangerous sin is. It's so important to be rid of sin. It's dangerous. It contaminates. I read recently about some energy bars, kind of breakfast bars, that were contaminated with listeria. That means they could make people very ill if they ate it. Now, the advice, if you had some of these energy bars, was to get rid of them, obviously. Don't eat them. Get rid of them. Destroy them. It's contaminated. The whole thing is affected. In fact, the whole batch of those energy bars was recalled and destroyed. And that's actually how we should treat sin. You see, if you had one of these energy bars in your cupboard and you knew about this, you wouldn't leave it in there and wait for one of your children to eat it. You'd get rid of it. You destroy it as quickly as possible, because it's contaminated and it's dangerous. Recently, I was driving in Spain, and I was driving up a mountain road. It's one of those roads where every sort of 100 yards you're going around a hairpin bend, and there's a kind of 600 foot drop here. And there are these signs every now and then with a triangle saying there's a warning of a bend. And underneath it said, Recuerde. I wonder if you know what recuerde means. No one does. So if you're in France, you'll see rappel. What does rappel mean? Reminder. It's reminder. Rappeler. Remember. Reminder. And I was thinking, as I was driving along this road, I thought, I'm very, very aware that there's this huge drop here, and I really don't feel like I need to be reminded by this sign every few hundred yards that there are bends and that it's dangerous. But then I thought, well, imagine if I was driving along this road every single day. Knowing my heart and knowing the way I drive, I probably would get complacent. I'd probably start to think, well, you know, nothing's gone wrong so far. I'd maybe start to forget about the danger. And perhaps I wonder, we're at risk of being complacent with the danger of sin. Maybe you sin and you think, I don't feel that guilty. Maybe you sin and you've hardened your heart and it doesn't feel like sin anymore. Maybe you sin and sometimes there aren't immediate consequences and you think, well, I seem to get away with it. It's not obviously such a big problem. But no, sin is dangerous, sin contaminates, sin destroys. We're crowded. Rappel, remember that. We need to deal with sin. We need to confess it. We need to repent of it. We need to do all that we can to remove the temptation to sin again. And look at the last verse, verse 26 of chapter 7. Over Achan, they heaped up a large pile of rocks, which remains to this day. Then the Lord turned from his fierce anger. Therefore, the valley, that place has been called the Valley of Achor ever since. There is another heap of stones. We've seen a heap of stones already where the people crossed the River Jordan. That was a reminder of God's great power bringing his people into the land. But here we have another heap of stones, another reminder, but it's a reminder of God's judgment, a reminder of the terrible consequences of sin. And God's anger turned away, and the place is called the Valley of Achor. And Achor means trouble. You probably see that in a footnote. So it's a kind of play on words with Achan's name, because Achan sounds a little bit like Achor. It's a kind of a morbid pun on this play of words. The Israelites are quite into that kind of thing, as you'll see if you read the rest of the Bible. But Achan, the one man, sinned. And the Lord's anger burned against the people of Israel. But by the death of the one man, Achan, the Lord's anger turned away from his people. It's not curtains for us when we sin. It's not curtains for the church when there's sin amongst us. But it must be dealt with. And how does that happen? Well, there are two places that are mentioned in this passage in Joshua chapter 7. And it's instructive to look at the future of these two places. So the first place is Ai. Now, not to steal too much from Rupert, but what happens to Ai is that it does eventually get captured by the Israelites. Flip forward to chapter 8 and verse 28, and you will see this. So Joshua burned Ai and made it a permanent heap of ruins, a desolate place to this day. That's another pun. So Ai means ruin. Joshua made it into a permanent ruin. God brings judgment on his enemies. Ai is a ruin, permanently a ruin. And what happens to the Valley of Achor? Well, turn forward with me to the book of Hosea and chapter 2. So Hosea is quite a long way away. It's in, if you have a blue Bible, it's on page 902. And this is what we read as God speaks to his people who have rebelled. Verse 14, God says, oh, some of you are still, I can hear pages turning. I'll wait until the page turning stops. Okay, Hosea chapter 2 and verse 14, therefore, says God, I am now going to allure her, talking about his people. I will lead her into the wilderness and speak tenderly to her. There I will give her back her vineyards. I will make the Valley of Achor a door of hope. There she will respond as in the days of her youth, as in the day she came up out of Egypt. What happened in the day she came up out of Egypt? God saved his people from the land of slavery, from the hand of the Egyptians. You see, the Valley of Achor, the memorial over the man who was under God's judgment on behalf of the people of God, becomes a door of hope. You see, the greater truth that we see as we look through the sweep of the rest of the Bible is that there are two groups of people, just like there are these two places. As Paul puts it in Romans 5, you're either associated with Adam, who brought sin, or you're associated with Jesus, who brought justification and forgiveness and new life. Sin needs to be dealt with, but ultimately, only God could deal with sin. Only through the death of the one righteous man, Jesus Christ, the wrath of God is turned away from his people forever. So the question is, are you and I where you'll be judged for your sin, the place that will become a permanent ruin? Or are you in the valley of Achor, where the one man died to turn away God's wrath from the many? I'm going to read from Hebrews 12 as we close. Therefore, since we are surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses, that's the kind of hall of fame in Hebrews 11, the people who lived by faith. Incidentally, that includes Joshua and Rahab. Since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles. And let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God.